The first of the Blood Horde reinforcements had made it to the cradles when the lights went out. They cursed the stupid Familia sods who had not the sense to surrender without playing childish tricks and turned on their own searchlights. The beams made harsh moving shadows of the construction machinery, the cradle supports, grapple housings, gantries, and the robotics that sprouted on them like barnacles on a dock. In the vacuum of the open repair bays, the laser rangefinders left no trace. The first victims didn't even see the little colored dots on their suits for squinting into that mass of bright lights and shifting shadows. They knew how to deal with this kind of resistance. It was tricky, with their own ship now moored in T4, but they lobbed in some of the little mines called bouncers and waited until three or four of them had blown up. They had proximity fuses, but would recognize patches on Blood Horde EVA suits, which made them only very dangerous to play with. They came on, alert for any more direct resistance. 100 more had made it alongside their own ship, alongside Wraith, when the lights came back on, flickered on and off several times, and then went out again. Helmet filters darkened, oscillated in response to the rapid changes, and finally cleared as the darkness came back. Again, their own lights probed the darkness, and they remembered the confusion they'd seen. They were not novices to be put off by such basic ploys. They didn't bunch up. They moved along in a disciplined skirmish line until their forward elements reached the airlock at the hub end of the repair bay. Then the big robotic sprayers, which had slid down the gantries centimeter by centimeter in the light, dropping meters whenever the lights weren't on them, rotated, aimed, and fired thick yellow liquid at them. It dispersed to a fine spray in the vacuum, a spray that adhered with equal rapidity to their suits, including the helmet viewplates. Not all of them got a full dose. Some, near the nozzles, were physically thrown off their feet by the force of the spray, and of those, a few managed to curl protectively into balls, so their helmet faceplates weren't entirely obscured. But it took a few critical moments to realize what had happened and its effect. In those few moments, their formation disintegrated. A few battered and blundered their way to airlocks, but the rest were blind, their external sensors clogged with spray, in some cases stuck fast to the deck by having unfortunately stepped on a coat of spray before it set completely. The suits were powered, they could pull free, but they couldn't see. They couldn't get the paint off with gloved hands. In fact, though they didn't know it, they'd have needed an unusual solvent to remove the paint without eating through the faceplate.
They're cursing the name in the war clan of someone named Volcrace.
Down on the deck of the repair bay, the brilliant yellow suits seemed almost to glow in the shadowy areas. Evidently, those mixing the paint had added reflectance and fluorescence to it.
Good. How many of them did the trap miss?
The external vid scans, hastily rigged a few hours before to cover areas not usually monitored, showed several clusters of Blood Horde invaders around the outer edges of the repair bays.
Perhaps 50, 100?
Let's keep them occupied.
The sprayers lifted much faster than they'd come down, the beaked nozzles rotating inward. Other machinery shifted up and down, back and forth, in an elaborate dance intended to look vaguely menacing. One enterprising operator detached one of the sprayers from its usual mounting and sent it toward the repair bay opening, as if in search of more troops to spray. He ran it out on a boom, its nozzles swinging threateningly from side to side, and watched on the vid scan as the Blood Horde troops shifted uneasily on their lines. One of them raised a weapon. His shot holed the paint reservoir. He hadn't thought what would happen if he succeeded. The bursting reservoir meant a cloud of dispersing paint, still tacky enough to cloud several more faceplates. The other troops lost the last remnants of discipline and rushed into the repair bay. Esme pulled herself into the ship. Both outer and inner hatches were open, which argued that anyone aboard would be in an EVA suit. She edged across to the inner hatch, noting the slightly greasy feel of a substandard artificial gravity generator, and peered around. She was looking into a large open compartment with rows of upright stanchions, each fitted with a top crossbar and several loops. It looked nothing like anything she'd seen in a fleet vessel. Then she realized how handy that apparatus would be for someone getting into an EVA suit without help. This was where the Blood Horde troops prepared for boarding.
Where's their bridge? Is anyone there?
Esme waved two of her people forward and two aft. She herself went forward behind the other two. She saw the leader's arm lift and held her breath. They and Bolri's team had the only five needlers available, weapons that were safe to use in the confines of a warship's bridge. His hand jerked twice, and then he moved forward. Esme followed, alert for movement from any direction. There was none. On the bridge, the Blood Horde had left two. She had no idea what their duties had been, and both were dead.
Let's get this ship going.
Someone dragged the bodies back to the big compartment near the locks. The specialists moved to their areas. The controls looked familiar enough, despite the odd lettering on the labels.
It's the Duke, Captain.
Esme started to tell Petty Major Simpkins she wasn't the captain when she remembered that she was, at least for the moment. A captain, if not the captain. Simpkins was her engineering section, ordinarily in drives and maneuver.
It's just a basic small freighter picked up with some weaponry. Shields are more than civ level. If the other shields are no better, it'll only take a few hits.
That it would take only a few enemy hits to destroy them was understood.
Weapons?
Weapons was Chief Aramanch, who held up a finger for a moment's more grace.
We've got almost a full arsenal of missiles, Captain, ample for the mission, but this thing has no beam weapons.
Which meant they'd have to come close to be sure of a kill.
Scan?
Power on, Captain. We're operational. And we have... There's Kossa's signal. The three other Blood Horde ships. One's probably a pirated super freighter, and the other's about this size.
Vokrace eyed the empty, curved passage uneasily. Something was different, and he couldn't be sure what.
Which deck is this?
Four.
Vokrace couldn't see or hear or smell anything definite, but he could not relax. Ever since he'd found that Bjerling was commanding, he'd had the feeling that things were going wrong.
Troubled pack leader.
Nothing I can taste, but...
His team was short-handed now. They were so few, and Bjerling hated him, he was sure. If Bjerling's people killed them all, it could be blamed on the Familius troops. No one would ever know.
We need a hostage. Someone Bjerling would want. Maybe those admirals, if any of them are still alive.
The Serrano cub?
No. If he's still alive, he's still just a cub. Bjerling will have to talk to us if we have important prisoners. And enough of his people were here to bear witness. Otherwise...
It's a bridge.
Yes, the bridge.
Running up the stairs ahead of the rest, his rage came back, and the energy with it. Bjerling's sons should all have shriveled balls. His daughters should all whore for prisoners in the arena. The Antbird Comity should fall to quarrels and jealousy, its last survivor dying poor and crippled. He saw the little pile of trash an instant too late to stop, and had just long enough to recognize what it might be instead, and extend his curses to the entire Familius Regnant. The question they couldn't answer ahead of time was what the other Blood Horde ships would do. Now, as they powered up Antbird's axe, Esme kept mental fingers crossed.
Think we ought to trust their life support?
No. Lift off when ready. Maximum acceleration. Ours, not theirs.
Antbird's axe bounded off the drive test cradle like a bucking horse. Its gravity generator compensated only a little.
Wow. I guess they moved the red line over.
18 decks of T3 flashed past. Then they were out in open space. Esme couldn't interpret the blurry scan she saw.
Where's the other one? Scan?
We're off. I'm taking the big one.
Scan.
Bam!
The scan image steadied, still grainy, but now she could interpret what she saw. Bolri's Blood Horde ship, that must be, veering from hers toward the biggest blip on the screen. The Blood Horde flagship, if they had flagships. Esme looked for her own target, which had been parked, as it were, some 1,000 kilometers on the far side of Kosciusko, where it had a clear shot down the throat of anyone coming through the jump point. Had it mined the jump point? She suspected not. Setting minefields wasn't a Blood Horde sort of thing to do, even if they had put that mine on Wraith. It didn't matter. She was going there anyway. The third Blood Horde ship, positioned in-system of the DSR from the jump point, would require a separate attack run. From where it was, missile attack would risk blowing Kosciusko. She hoped it was like this one in having no beam weapons.
Got it. Ready on your order, Captain.
That ship wants to know what you think you're doing. They're saying this is no time for dancing with the bear, whatever that means.
Esme's mind grappled with the geometry of it. Their motion relative to Kosciusko, to the Bloodhorde ship, to the other Bloodhorde ship. The distance, the velocity of the weapons, the probable quality of the other ship's shields, its maneuvering ability.
Hold it. We're going closer.
Going closer was like riding a polo pony. Antbird's axe, whatever its shortcomings by fleet standards, bounced happily from heading to heading with no resistance. She had been right to close. The other ship could dodge as well. Instead, it held its position, as if certain she was no threat.
The big one's moving, putting out quite a plume, but Bowery should have it.
Range in, Captain. Go ahead.
Aramanch hit the controls. The whole ship shuddered with every departing missile.
It's no wonder they don't mount beams on this thing. It'd fall apart.
On track. It's got...
The screen flared, and their target disappeared.
Good shot. Now let's go after that third one.
Two down.
That must have been Bowery in the other Bloodhorde ship. Surely they hadn't gotten Wraith out that fast.
Lovely shot.
Esme glanced at Lucian's screen and saw that it was now much crisper than before. Maybe he was a genius. Their ship's artificial gravity wobbled as Simkins tried to maneuver sharply enough to get a good angle on the third Bloodhorde ship. It had boosted toward Kosciusko, then veered as both Esme and Bowery went after it.
It's launched missiles. Tracking. One flight at Kos and one each at us and Bowery. Lousy aim. You'd think with a target the size of Kos.
We're not going to make it. It...
Wraith's position lighted up on Lucian's scan.
All hot. I didn't know they had that much left.
Got him.
And the entire portside array of beam weapons focused on the fleeing Bloodhorde ship, overwhelming its shields. The screen flared again, a final time.
Captain to captain, I'd say there'd be no rank pulling on this array, huh? One each. That's pretty fair shooting. Even if two of them were sitting ducks.
Not our fault. Besides, you two had to get them with their own guns. That brings the challenge up to an acceptable level.
Thank you.
Esme grinned at her crew.
All right, let's get this thing back to Kos before someone else takes a pot shot at us.
There's nobody in this system who'd dare.
Esme brought Antbird's axe back to the test cradle with no flourishes. A Kosciusko crew waited to talk them into the docking pad and tie the little ship down with appropriate care. She supervised the power down, the locking of weapons. She made sure the two Bloodhorde corpses were bagged and turned over to the deck crew. Simkins handed her the little red key, an actual key, she was startled to note, completely unlike the command wands that Fleet used to unlock controls, and she tucked it into the holdall of her suit. Then she followed the others out of the ship and closed the hatches herself. When they got back to Kosciusko, back into aired space and out of suits that had acquired a stench all their own, Esme found herself the center of a mass of people. Her crew, Wraith's crew, Bowery's crew, coming at a dead run through the tunnel, and at least half the people who'd been left in T3. She was hugged, pummeled. She and the other two captains were lifted shoulder high, carried through the passages toward the core, where she saw Admiral Dosignol, standing a little lopsided, near the lift tube cluster. Ceviche and Major Patak were beside him, watching her. The crowd slowed, still exuberant, but aware of stars and their implication. Esme managed to wriggle down and then make her way out of the crush.
Sir.
Good work, Lieutenant. Congratulations to all of you.
Is there any word
of Ensign Serrano?
Esme nodded and braced herself for the worst.
Yes. He was found. He's badly hurt, but alive.
He had not died because she'd done nothing. With the knowledge that he was still alive, her heart lifted to impossible heights. She turned back to the crowd, hunting for those she knew.
You did it! You did it! We did it!
Admiral Dosignol leaned over to Patak.
I do believe we can quit worrying, Major. I do believe that life has given her that kick in the pants.
By the time Esme finally got some sleep, while others headed Kosciusko back toward Familia space, her initial euphoria had worn away. She woke several times, her heart pounding from dreams she couldn't quite recall. She felt angry, but couldn't find a target for her anger. The Blood Horde intruders were dead. No use to be angry with them. Nothing seemed right. But of course, schedules and ship services were still upset. Those who had been aboard Antbird's Axe with her came around for more congratulations. It was hard to give them the responses they deserved. She wanted to, but she felt empty of anything but unfocused irritation. When Lieutenant Bowery sought her out and told her he'd be glad to give her a strong recommendation for a switch to command track, she felt a prickle of fear. Another sleep cycle helped, but in the next, one of the nightmares caught her again. Esme turned on the light and lay staring at the overhead.
Why can't I get over this? I am not that child anymore. I commanded a ship!
Despite didn't count, but she allowed herself credit for Antbird's Axe.
Only because it had suspected nothing. Only because its captain had been stupid.
Her mind led her through the many ways every decision she'd made could have gone wrong. She had been hasty, impulsive, just like that child who had run away. She could have gotten everyone killed.
Others thought I did well.
But she knew things about herself they didn't. If they knew everything, they'd understand that she could not really be qualified. She had been lucky, and she'd been supported by skilled crew. It would be safer for everyone if she went back into obscurity where she belonged. She could have a decent life if she'd just kept out of trouble. Esme's throat tightened. She saw the faces of her crew. For a moment, she could feel the surge of confidence that had freed her to make those critical decisions. That was the person she wanted to be, the person who felt at home, undivided, the person who had earned the respect the others gave her. They could not respect her if they knew about the nightmares. She grimaced, picturing herself as a cruiser captain who followed each battle with a round of nightmares. She could see the crew tiptoeing around, listening to the thrashing and moaning. For a moment, it seemed almost funny. Then her eyes filled.
No. I have to find a way to change this.
Esme pushed herself up and headed for the showers. The next shift, word came down that Baron was out of regen and could have visitors. Esme didn't really want to know what horrors he'd endured, but she had to visit him. Baron's eyes had no light in them. He looked less like a Serrano than Esme had ever seen him. She told herself he was probably sedated.
Want some company?
Baron flinched, then stiffened, looking past her ear.
Lieutenant Suiza, I hear you did good things.
I did what I could.
More than I did.
That flat tone that sent prickles down Esme's spine. She could just remember that flatness in her own voice, in that time she didn't want to think about.
I don't belong. A Serrano. A real Serrano, like my grandmother or Harris. They'd have done something.
In the split second before she spoke, awareness of what she was going to say almost clamped her jaw shut.
When I was caught...
You were captured? They didn't tell me that. I'll bet you gave him a rough time.
She could not look at him. She could not look at anything but the moving shadows in her mind as they came clear out of the fog.
I was a child. I didn't give anyone a hard time. I was looking for my father. My mother had died. A fever we have on Altiplano. And my father was off with his army, fighting a civil war.
Esme told the story as quickly, as baldly as she could, trying not to think as she told it. The runaway, the fat woman on the train, the explosions, the village with dead bodies she had thought were sleeping. Then the uniformed men, the hard hands, the pain, the helplessness that was worse than pain.
Esme. Lieutenant. I didn't know.
No. It's not something I talk about. My family had insisted it was a dream. A fever dream. I was sick a long time. The same fever my mother had had. They said I'd run away, gotten near the front, been hurt. But the rest of it was just a dream, they said.
The rest of it?
The man, he was someone I knew. Had known in my father's command.
And they lied to you? They lied to you about that?
They thought it was best. They thought they were protecting me.
It wasn't It wasn't someone in your own family.
No.
But you went on. You were strong. You didn't...
I cried. I cried night after night. They put me in a room at the top of the house at the end of the hall because I woke them up thrashing around so much. I was afraid of everything, and afraid of being afraid. If they knew how scared I was, they would despise me. They were all heroes. My father, my uncles, my cousins, even my Aunt Sonny. Papa Stefan had no use for crybabies. I couldn't cry in front of him. Put it behind you, they said. What's past is past, they said.
But surely they knew. Even I know from my foster family that children don't just forget things like that.
On Altiplano, you forget. Or you leave. I left. Which relieved them because I was always trouble for them.
I can't believe you were trouble.
Oh, yes. A Suiza woman who did not ride, who did not involve herself with stock breeding, who did not flirt and attract the right sort of young men. My poor stepmother spent years on me trying to make me normal, and none of it worked.
But you got into the Fleet Prep School program. He must have recovered very well. What did the psych nannies say? Did they give you any additional therapy?
I had read psych books on Altiplano. There wasn't any therapy available there. And after all, I passed the exams.
I can't believe...
I just did it.
Baron flinched, and Esme realized how he might take that.
It's not the same for you.
No. I'm a grown man. Or supposed to be.
You are. And you did what you could. It's not your fault.
But a Serrano is supposed to...
You were a captive. You had no choices. Except to survive or die. Do you think I never tortured myself with a Suiza is supposed to? Of course I did. But it doesn't help. And it doesn't matter what you did. Even if you spewed your guts.
I did.
So, that's your body. If it wants to vomit, it will. If it wants to leak, it will. You can't stop it.
Somehow I can't see my grandmother admiral puking all over a muscle-bound blood horde commando just because someone mentioned the arena combat.
You had been hit in the head, hadn't you?
Not that hard.
Esme fought down a flash of anger. She had told him things she had not told anyone else, and he was still determined to wallow in his own guilt.
They'll want me to talk about it.
Who?
The psych nannies, of course. Just as they did with you. I don't want to talk about it.
Of course not.
How bad is it? What do they say? What do they put in your record?
It's not too bad. You'll do fine.
Quickly, she moved toward the door. Baron raised a hand still streaked with the pink stain of new skin glue.
Lieutenant, please.
What?
Esme turned back to him, and his eyes widened at what he saw on her face.
You haven't talked to the Sykes, have you? Ever?
I...
You just hit it, didn't you? By yourself.
Yes. I had to. It was the only way, and it's better. I'm fine now.
Just like me.
No. I'm older. It's been longer. I do know what you're feeling, but it gets better.
This is what confused people.
What do you mean, confused?
It wasn't just the difference in Altiplano's social customs and fleets. It was this secret you had. That's why your talents were all locked up, hidden. Why it took combat to unlock them, let you show what you could do.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You need help as much as I do.
No, I don't. I'm fine now. It's under control, as you say. I can function.
Not at your best. I heard about your best. Grandmother said the combat analysis was unbelievable.
Your grandmother wasn't on the Board of Inquiry.
Boards of Inquiry exist to scare captains into heart attacks and ulcers. What I heard through the family was how the real commanders, who have combat experience, saw it. And no one, grandmother included, could understand how you did it. She said that you were hiding something, something that kept you from showing what you could do.
Well, it's not hidden now. I did command that ship. Actually, two of them now.
Not that.
I told you, it's not hidden.
I'm not a psych nanny. Do you think my telling you about my experience would be sufficient?
No. They know already. You have to talk to them. And they'll help you, I'm sure of it.
Mm-hmm. So sure that you will talk to them too?
Me?
Don't play dumb with me. You know you're not healed. You know you still need help.
They'll throw me out. A mutineer who had craziness in her past? They'll send me back.
Oh, no, they won't. Grandmother won't let them.
Your grandmother doesn't run everything in Fleet.
No, but it doesn't hurt to have her on your side, which you do. She She's not about to lose an officer she considers brilliant. And if you talk to them about your problem... See, I've never met anyone. I've never felt...
You want a partner? Is that what you're saying?
Baron nodded without speaking. Clear in his expression was the effort it cost him to pull himself out of his own pain long enough to reach out to her. Esme's heart pounded. Her breath came short.
You already told me. It's not like it'll be the first time for you.
When you hit the ground, Papa Stefan had always said, it was too late to be scared of being bucked off. You had already survived the worst. Now all you had to do was catch the horse and get back on.
I caught the horse.
Esme almost laughed at Baron's confusion.
All right. I will talk to them. But you have to cooperate, too. I want a Serrano ally closer to my own age than your estimable grandmother or your ferocious cousin. Is that a deal?
Deal. Although I'm not sure you got the right adjective with the right relative.
Major Patak looked up when Esme came back from sickbay.
How's the boy?
Shaken up but healing. He's got to see the psychs, he says.
Standard. Is it bothering him?
As much as it would bother anyone. Major, back before all this happened, you said perhaps I should see the psychs about what happened on Despite.
Is that still bothering you?
Not just that. I know we're shorthanded, but I'd like to do that.
Patak gave her a long, steady look.
Good. Go find out how long it will take and let me know. You're in enough good graces right now that nobody's going to grudge you some help. Would you like me to call over there and find out when they can take you?
Thank you, Major, but I think I should do it myself.
You don't have to do everything the hard way, Sweeza.
Setting up an appointment was absurdly easy. The appointments clerk didn't ask for details when she said she wanted a psych appointment. Just asked if it was urgent.
Is it urgent?
Esme could put it off by saying it wasn't, but putting it off hadn't solved it before.
Not an emergency, but it's interfering with things.
Just a moment.
Of course they're busy. Baron isn't the only one with urgent needs.
Lieutenant Sweeza, this is Annie Marinha. I need just a few bits of information in order to place you with the individual most likely to help you.
Esme's throat closed. She could say nothing, and waited for the questions as if they were blows.
Is this related only to the recent events, or is it something else?
Something else.
I see that you were in a difficult situation aboard Despite, and received no psych support services subsequently. Is this related to that?
She could say yes and be telling the truth, but not the whole truth. She could tell them the rest later, surely. But lies had started this, and she wanted it over.
Partly. It's all mixed up with...
Predating your entrance to the regular space service?
Yes.
There's nothing on your record.
No, Please, I can't explain it like this.
Certainly.
A pause, during which Esme imagined damning check marks on a laundry list of mental illness that would bar her forever from anything she wanted to do.
I can see you at 1400 today. T5, deck 7. Follow the signs to psych and ask the front desk clerk... You're on the schedule, all right?
It was not all right. She needed more time to get herself ready for this. But she could hardly complain that they were helping her too quickly.
That's fine. Thank you.
You'll need about 2 hours. We'll arrange the rest of your sessions once we've met.
Thank you.
Esme glanced at the time. 10:30. She had that long to live as she had lived, however that was. It felt like doom coming down on her. She went to tell Major Patak she would be gone for several hours.
That's fine. In the meantime, I want you to have lunch with me.
Major, I'm really not hungry.
True, but you're also tied up in knots. I'm not asking what it's about now that you're getting help, but I'm also not letting you mope around by yourself. Soup and salad. You need something before you go over there and spill your guts. It's going to be exhausting.
The clerk in the reception area smiled at her.
Lieutenant Sweeza, I know you don't know me, but we all want to thank you for what you did.
I spent most of the time flat out, having dreams I can't even remember. No good to anyone. If it hadn't been for you...
Esme accepted the file the clerk handed her.
And a lot of others.
Oh, sure. But everyone knows you took that Blood Horde ship and fought them off. They ought to make you a cruiser captain. That's what I think.
The clerk looked at a screen at his desk.
There. The room will be ready in just a couple of minutes. We like to freshen it up between... Do you want something to drink?
Her mouth was dry again, but she didn't think she could drink. Her stomach had knotted shut.
No, thank you.
Your first time with psych support?
Esme nodded. She hated to be that transparent.
Everyone's scared beforehand. But we haven't killed anyone yet.
Esme tried to smile, but she didn't really think it was funny. Nubbly, toast-brown carpet ran halfway up the bulkheads, here painted cream. A fat cushioned couch with an afghan draped over one end and a couple of soft chairs made the little compartment look more like a particularly cozy sitting room. It was quiet and smelled faintly of mint. Esme, aware that she had stopped in the doorway like a wary colt halfway through a gate, forced herself to go on. The woman inside was tall, with a thick braid of light hair going silver at the temples. She wore soft brown pants and a blue shirt, with her ID tag clipped to the left sleeve.
I'm Annie Marinha. We don't use ranks here, so I'll call you Esme. Unless you have a favorite nickname?
Esme's fine.
Good. I called up your medical records earlier, of course, but that was all. There are some other things you need to know about the process before we get started, if you feel you can understand them at this time.
Esme dragged her wits back from their hiding places. She had expected to have to tell everything at once. This was much duller, if less painful.
The slang for most of us is psych nannies, as I'm sure you know. That's reasonably accurate, because most of us are nannies, not med techs or psychiatric physicians. You're from Altiplano, where I believe they still call nannies nurses, is that right?
Yes.
Do you have any cultural problems with being in the care of a psych nanny rather than a physician?
No.
Annie checked off something.
Now, you need to know that although our sessions are confidential, there are limits to this confidentiality. If I have reason to believe that you are a danger to yourself or others, I will report that. Do you want to go on?
Yes.
All right. Now, we get to the heart of it. You said you had problems connected both with your experiences on Despite and with other experiences from before you joined the service. I would have expected problems existing when you joined to have been dealt with at that time.
I thought it was only nightmares.
There is a question on the intake physical about excessive nightmares.
Yes, and I should have said something, but I didn't know for sure they were excessive, and I wanted to get away, to get into prep school.
Well, how old were you then?
14. They said the application was good, but to wait a year or so because I'd already filled up, and besides, they wanted me to take extra courses. So I did, and then...
You did get into prep school. The dreams?
They weren't as bad then. I thought I was outgrowing whatever it was.
You didn't know?
No. They said it was only dreams.
And now you know differently.
I do. I found out when I went home, after the court-martial, that it was true. It was all real, and they lied to me.
What I understand you to say is that something happened when you were a child, before you joined Fleet, and your family lied, told you it had never happened, and you only dreamed it. Is that true?
Yes.
Mark down another one for the misguided, abusive families of the world.
Oh, they're not abusive. They're just...
Esme, listen. How painful was it to think you were going crazy because you had unreasonable, disgusting, terrifying, bad dreams?
Very.
And did you have that pain every day?
Yes, except when I was too busy to think about it.
If you tormented someone every day, made them miserable every day, scared them every day, made them think they were bad and crazy every day, would you call that abusive?
Of course, but my family wasn't. They didn't know.
We'll talk about it. So the first problem you have is these dreams that turned out not to be dreams. Of something bad that happened when you were a child. How old were you when it happened?
Almost 6.
Do you still have the same dreams, now that you know what it is?
Yes, sometimes. And I keep worrying about it.
And your second problem has to do with your experiences aboard Despite?
Yes, The mutiny. I've had dreams about that, too. Sometimes they're mixed up, as if both things were happening at once.
I'm not surprised. Although you haven't told me yet what kind of childhood trauma it was, there are parallels. In both instances, you were under someone's protection. That protection failed, and someone you trusted turned out to be against you. I presume the mutiny on Despite involved a lot of close contact fighting aboard?
Yes.
So, of course, the Bloodhorde intrusion here would rekindle the same feelings and tie into the earlier trauma as well.
I wasn't quite as scared this time. Not at the time, anyway.
Luckily for the rest of us. Now, have you ever told anyone about the events in your childhood?
My family already knows.
That's not what I asked. Have you ever told anyone since you grew up?
One person. Baron Serrano. Because he was feeling so bad about having to consult you and what happened to him.
Baron Serrano? Oh, the ensign in sick bay. He's assigned to someone else. Interesting. Your friends?
Yes.
It must have been hard for you to tell him. How did he react?
I don't know what a normal reaction is. He was mad at my father.
Good for him. That's what I'd call a normal reaction. Now, since you've told it once, do you think you could tell me?
Esme took a breath and plunged into the story again. It was no easier, but no harder, even though Annie was a stranger. When she faltered, Annie asked just enough to get her started again. Finally, she was sure it had taken hours. She got to the end.
I thought maybe I'd gone crazy, from the fever or something.
That's one thing you don't have to worry about, Esme. By any definition of sanity, you're well onto the sane side. You always were. Your defenses were normal ones. It was your family's response, which, if it manifested in an individual, would be called insane, or at least unsound.
But they weren't crazy. They weren't the ones waking up everyone in the house at night screaming.
Esme, nightmares are not a symptom of insanity. Something awful happened to you. You had nightmares about it, a normal reaction. But your family tried to pretend it hadn't happened, and that your normal nightmares were the real problem. That's a failure to face reality. And being out of touch with reality is a symptom of mental illness. It's just as serious when a family or other group does it as when one person does it.
Oh, but...
It's hard to connect your normal family, living their everyday lives, with your mental image of insanity. I'm not surprised. But let me reassure you, you are sane. And the symptoms you've had are treatable. We'll need to spend some time at it here, and you'll have some assignments to complete on your own. They should take about 2 hours between our sessions, which I'm setting up twice a decade for now, every 5 days. Now, do you have any questions about the process?
Esme was sure she had questions, but she couldn't think of them. She had an overwhelming desire to lie down and sleep. She felt as tired as if she'd been working out for 2 hours.
You will probably have some somatic symptoms for the first several sessions. You'll be tired, perhaps achy. You may be tempted to skip meals or binge on desserts. Try to eat regularly and moderately. Allow extra time for sleep if you can.
All very well to say that, but what good is time for sleep if I can't sleep?
Esme acquired an intimate knowledge of every flaw in the surface of bulkhead and overhead, every object in her quarters. When she shut her eyes, she felt wider awake than before, heart racing. At meals, she dutifully forced down one mouthful after another, mimicking whoever sat fourth down on the left, taking a bite when he or she did. No one seemed to notice. She felt suspended in a hollow sphere. Nothing seemed quite within reach. To her surprise and relief, no one seemed to expect her to do more than routine work, even though the ship was shorthanded. The simple tasks engaged her fully, kept her busy. Whatever burst of energy had sent her across the ship, into the enemy's craft, into battle, had vanished. Someone else could figure out how to get Kosciusko back to Familia space, back to the rest of the fleet deployment. She couldn't quite manage to care. In the next session, Esme found herself defending her family again.
They didn't understand.
You had nightmares. You screamed so much you said that they banished you to a distant part of the house.
It wasn't banishment.
For a child to sleep alone that far from anyone else, I call that banishment. And you had changed in ways that most adults would recognize as a response to stress, hadn't you? Whenever a child's behavior changes suddenly, there's a reason. Gradual change is not so diagnostic. Exposure to new experiences can mean new enthusiasms replace the old, but sudden change means something. And a child's family is supposed to notice and look for the cause. In your case, of course, they already had a cause they knew about.
But it wasn't connected. They said I'd just gotten lazy.
Children don't just get lazy. That's an adult's quick label for some behavior they don't like. You had liked riding before, then you quit, and forgot you'd ever enjoyed it, and you think that's not related to a sexual assault?
I suppose it could be.
Do you remember whether the assault was in a building or outside?
All the buildings were destroyed, at least partly. I'd found a corner, taller than I was, but only a little. There was straw, and I'd crawled into it.
What did it smell like?
A whiff of that smell. Not the smoke, but the other smell blew across her mind.
Barn. It was a barn. It smelled like home.
It's probably why you were in it. Your nose leading you to something that didn't scare you silly. So there, in a place you had thought safe. Remember, smells go straight into the emotional center of the brain. You were assaulted in the most terrifying way by someone whose uniform you had previously associated with safety. Is it any wonder you hated cleaning stalls later?
I wasn't just lazy, or being a sissy about the horses moving around.
No. Your accurate memory told you that barns weren't really safe, that bad things could happen if you were trapped in a corner. Your brain was working fine, Esme, trying to keep you safe.
But I should have been able to.
Whoa. In the first place, you could no more change the new insight your experience gave you than a low-level computer can change the program you feed into it. If you'd had proper treatment early on with neuroactive drugs, the worst of the damage could have been prevented. But there would always have been a trace of it. That's what life is, after all. That's why mind wipes are illegal.
What about the nightmares?
Those should diminish, possibly disappear forever. Though you might get a recurrence in another period of extraordinary stress. Other patterns of thought which have impeded your development as a person or as an officer will change with continued practice.
I don't like the idea of drugs.
Good. People who like the idea of drugs have usually medicated themselves with things that don't work and leave neurons flapping in the breeze. You don't have to like your medicine. You just have to trust me to know when you need it.
Can't I do without it?
Possibly. Slower and with more difficulty. And not as certainly. What do you think the drugs will do? Turn you into one of those people in horror cubes who drags around in an asylum in ratty slippers?
That was indeed the image that had come to mind. Esme's head dipped in a weak nod.
When you're ready for drugs, Esme, I'll tell you exactly what to expect. Right now, let's get back to the other connections between what happened and the things you quit doing, quit enjoying.
She had quit enjoying horses. That still shocked her more than the nightmares. She had not even remembered enjoying them. The image Seb Coron gave her of a child hardly ever off her pony felt alien. How could she have been that child and become this woman? Yet if she believed him about the rape, she had to believe him about the pony. It would mean nothing to Fleet, she was sure. But in her own family, that by itself had made her different, inferior. Could it really be just a matter of smells, of her olfactory system going its own stubborn way, associating the smell of barns and horses with all the terror and pain of that day? It seemed too simple. Why couldn't her nose have associated all the pleasure she'd had, if that pleasure had been real? Her nose chose that moment to comment on the smell of dinner, which she had been forking into her mouth without thinking about it. She hadn't noticed anything for days, but now a smell got through, and she realized that her mouth was full of ganache stew. She hated ganache stew.
Ugh.
Come play ball, Lieutenant?
Esme's mind thrashed around, not finding a name for the pleasant-faced young woman. Baron would have known. Baron had not been around for a while. Therapy. He probably felt like she did, in no mood for games. She needed an excuse.
No thanks. I need to work out. Maybe another day.
From there to the gym, uncrowded in the aftermath of the battles, she climbed on one of the treadmills. When she glanced aside, her gaze caught on the mechanism of the virtual horse. She had not been on one in her entire fleet career. If she didn't enjoy riding real horses, why bother with a simulator?
It wouldn't smell like a real one.
The thought insinuated itself, and her mind threw up a picture of Lucy on the brown mare, the two graceful young animals enjoying movement. Pain stabbed her. Had she been, could she have been like Lucy? Could she have had that grace?
Evening, Lieutenant.
A jig moved past her to the horse. He mounted clumsily, and Esme could tell by the machine's movement that he had set it for basic mode, a slow trot in a straight line. Even so, he was off rhythm, posting just behind the beat. She could do better. Even now she could do better, and she knew it. Her mind threw up images of speed and beauty and grace, of Lucy, and almost tickling at the edge of awareness of herself. On the wall of Annie's room, a flat screen displayed a vague, misty landscape in soft greens and golds. Nothing like Altiplano, where the mountains stood out crisply against the sky. But it was a planet. She felt grounded by even that little.
In your culture, part of the global definition of woman or girl is someone to be protected. You were a girl, and you were not protected.
Esme curled into the afghan, not quite shivering, and focused on its texture, its warmth. Someone had crocheted it by hand. She spotted a flaw in the pattern.
A child's reasoning is different. You were not protected, so your child's mind, protecting your father as children do, and the more strongly because your mother had just died, your child's mind decided that either you were not really a girl, or you were not a good girl, and in either case, you did not deserve protection. My guess would be that your mind, for reasons of its own, chose the not really a girl branch.
Why do you say that?
Because of your behavior as an adolescent and adult. The ones who think they're bad girls act like bad girls, whatever that means for their culture of origin. For you, I suppose it would have been having affairs with anything that had a Y chromosome. You've been conspicuously good. At least, that's what your fitness reports say. But you haven't formed any lasting relationships with either sex. Also, you've chosen a career at odds with your culture's definition of women, as if you were a son rather than a daughter.
But that's just Altiplano.
Yes, but that's where you were raised. That's what formed your deepest attitudes towards the basics of human behavior. Do you fit in as a woman in your society?
Well, no.
Are you far enough from their norm to make them uneasy?
Yes. Does that mean I'm not really a woman now?
Heavens, no. By the standards of Fleet, and most of the rest of Familias, your interests and behaviors are well within the definition. Celibacy's unusual, but not rare. Besides, you haven't considered it a problem until now, have you?
Esme shook her head.
My guess, and it's only a guess, not an expert opinion, is that when you've got the rest of this straightened out, you'll find it easy to decide whether you want a partner. And if you do, you'll find one.
Session after session, in that quiet, cozy room with its soft textures, its warm colors, she had quit dreading them, though she wished they weren't necessary. It still seemed slightly indecent to spend so much time talking about herself and her family, especially when Annie refused to excuse her family for their mistakes.
We're dealing in reality here, and the reality is that they made what happened to you worse. Their response left you feeling less competent and more helpless.
But I was helpless.
Yes and no. In one way, any child that age is helpless against an adult. They lack the physical strength to defend themselves without help. But physical helplessness and the sensation of helplessness are not quite the same thing.
I'm confused. If you're helpless, you feel helpless.
Let me try again. Did you feel helpless in a rainstorm?
No.
You might be frightened in some situations, but not helpless. When adults impose responsibility on a child for events the child could not control, the child is helpless to refuse it, or the guilt that follows.
And that's what they did.
Yes.
So when I got angry, when I found out...
A reasonable reaction.
I'm still angry with them.
Of course.
But you said I'd get over it.
In years, not days. Give yourself time. You have a lot to be angry about.
I suppose there are worse things.
We're not talking about other people's problems here. We're talking about yours. You were not protected. And when you were hurt, they lied to you. As a result, you had a lot of bad years and missed a lot of normal growing experiences.
I could have...
Esme, I can guarantee one thing about your child self before this happened.
What?
You had iron will. The universe is lucky that your family did get a sense of responsibility into you, because if you'd chosen the bad branch, you'd have been a criminal beyond compare.
Esme had to laugh at that. She even agreed to take the neuroactives Annie said she was ready for. It was the first time since Baron's release from sickbay that they'd had a chance to talk. They had come to the wall, but no one was climbing. Just as well. Esme didn't feel like climbing anyway. When she looked at the wall, she saw the outside of the ship, the vast surfaces that always seemed to be just over vertical.
So, how's it going with the psych stuff?
I hate it. It wasn't too bad when I started, just talking to Annie. It actually helped, I think. But then she insisted I go to that group thing.
I hate that, too. Waste time. Some of them just ramble on and on, never getting anywhere.
Yeah, I thought it would be scary and painful, but half the time I'm just bored.
Sam says that's why therapy happens in special times and places, because listening to someone talk about themselves for hours is boring unless you're trained to do something in response.
Sam's your psych nanny?
Yes. I wish you were in my group. I'm still having trouble talking about it to them. They want to make a big thing about the physical damage, the broken bones and all. That's not what was worst.
What was worse, then?
Not being who I'm supposed to be. Not being able to do anything. I didn't manage to put a scratch on them. Slow them down, anything.
I have trouble forgiving myself, too. Even though I know in my mind that it wasn't possible, it still feels as if it was my weakness, mental weakness, that didn't stop them.
My group keeps telling me there was nothing I could do, but it feels different to me. Sam says I haven't heard it from the right person yet.
From your family?
He means me. He thinks I think too much about the family. I'm supposed to make my own standards, he says, and judge myself that way. He never had a grandmother like mine.
Or a grandfather like mine. But I see his point. Would it help if your grandmother told you you'd done as much as you could?
Not really. I thought about that, and I know what I'd think if she did. Poor Baron. Have to cheer him up. Give him a boost. I don't want to be poor Baron. I want to be who I was before.
That won't work. That's the one thing that won't work. You can't be who you were. You can only become someone else that you can live with.
Is that all we can hope for, Ez? Just acceptable? I'm not happy with that. If I have to change, fine, I'll change, but I want to be someone I can respect and like. Not just someone I can live with.
You Serranos have high standards.
Well, there's this Sweeza around who keeps setting me an example.
Esme didn't want to be the one setting examples. She hadn't been able to live up to any. New Insight pounced on that, turned it inside out, put it in the imaginary sun to air. As a child, she had copied the people she loved and admired. She had tried to be what they wanted, as much as she understood it. Where she had failed was not only not her fault. It wasn't, in the larger context of the Fleet and Familius Regnant, even failure. Fleet seemed to think she had set an acceptable example. Now that the Kosciusko was back with its companions, she heard rumors of the reactions in high places. Her head cleared, little by little, from the initial murk of therapy. She saw that Patak and Ceviche were not just tolerating her weak need for therapy, they wanted her to take the time she needed. The ensigns and jigs at her table at mess treated her with the exact flavor of respectful attention which a lifetime's experience of the military told her meant genuine affection. They liked her. They respected her. And not her fame or her background, which they didn't know anyway. She was the only Suiza, the only Altiplanin, any of them had ever met. And they liked her. With reason, Annie said when she confessed her embarrassment, her confusion. Slowly, she came to believe it, each day's experience layering a thin glaze of belief over the self-doubts. Esme peered out the observation ports to the patterns of lights on T1 and T5. She and Baron had found a quiet corner of the crafts activity compartment. The climbing club was busy on the wall, and Baron had confessed he felt no more eagerness for climbing than she did. She thought he looked a lot better. She knew she felt better. She had had no nightmares for the past 20 days and was beginning to hope they were gone forever.
I could get attached to the old girl. She's an amazing ship.
Baron looked up from the model he was putting together, the skeleton of some exotic beast. She could not read his expression, but she saw tension in the muscles of his face.
You're going to transfer to maintenance command?
It's tempting. There's a lot more to learn here.
Fine for a sponge.
Fretting, are we? Eager to get back to the real fleet?
Well, therapy's going well, even the group part. It may even, in the very long run, turn out to be something worthwhile.
Look out, all admirals. Someone's after your job?
Not quite. By the time I get to that age, there may be no slots for new admirals anyway. That's another reason to get back into my own track as soon as possible. How's your stuff going?
Stuff? I'm not shy about it, Baron. The sessions have helped. I still wish I knew how much of the change was me and how much was in those medications, but they say it doesn't matter.
So what are you going to do? Back into technical track and a scan?
I'm transferring. If they approve, which I hope they will, so far they're being encouraging.
Transfer to what, you annoying woman?
Command track. I think it's time if you dirtborn outsiders health command.
Yes! Please, when you get your first legal command, wangle me a place in your crew.
Wangle? You Serranos can wangle all you want, but Suizas expect to earn command.
Gods help us all. We let the Suizas off Altiplano.
Let?
Esme reached out and tickled him. Startled, he dropped the model onto the desk.
You touched me.
I'm an idiot.
No, you're human, overwhelmed by my charm.
You wish.
Yes, I do.
With a sudden change of expression, he slowly reached out and touched her cheek.
I do wish an alliance with this Suiza of Altiplano. Not just because Suiza has pulled Serrano out of trouble twice now, but because I do like you, admire you, and most desperately wish you'd like me enough to welcome me into your life and into your bed.
Baron,
though not if the prospect disgusts you, of course. Only if... I never thought you'd touch me, aside from whacking me with your elbow in a wall ball game.
Look, I'm inexperienced to the point of total ignorance. Barring what I saw in the farm as a girl, which involved biting and kicking and hobbles.
Esme.
Inexperienced, I said. Not, you will notice, unwilling.
In the long silence that followed, watching the shifting expressions play over his face, feeling the first feather touch of his fingers on her face, on her hair, Esme laid the last fiery ghost to rest. Awards ceremonies all had the same structure. Esme wondered if all recipients felt a little silly, so far removed from the mood in which they'd done whatever it was that got them honored. As Admiral Foxworth spoke briefly to each recipient, she found she could believe that the others deserved their medals, that those awards were real. It was hers that felt wrong. But why was it right for others but wrong for her? She knew the answer to that now, knew the roots of that belief. But if she became that person who could be honored, then what? Then someone might expect her to be what the award made her seem, what they judged she was ready for. She almost grinned, making that connection.
Lieutenant Esme Sweeza.
Esme stood, came forward as directed, and listened as Admiral Foxworth read the citation. She waited for him to pick up the ribbon his aide held on a tray, but instead he raised one bushy gray eyebrow.
You know, Lieutenant, I've seen the summary of the Board of Inquiry.
Esme wondered if she was supposed to answer that. Finally, he went on.
The final paragraph specifically notes that you are not to be in command of any combat vessel until such time as you have demonstrated competence in relevant training exercises. Yet I find that your citation says you took command of the vessel Antbird's Axe, which subsequently engaged enemy vessels in a hostile encounter. Your commander praises your initiative, when I would think he should condemn your blatant disregard of the findings of that Board of Inquiry. Do you have anything to say, Lieutenant?
Well, sir, my recollection is that the board said I should not command any RSS combat vessels until further training. It didn't say anything about Blood Horde ships.
A long moment passed, during which Esme had ample time to regret her boldness and consider the power of angry admirals. Then a slow grin creased his face, and he looked past her to the rest of the assembly.
And she could think on her feet.
Esme felt the blood rushing to her cheeks. The Admiral picked up the decoration and pinned it on.
Congratulations, Lieutenant Sweeza.
Coming back to her seat, she caught Baron's eye. He was sparkling all over with delight in her, and she indulged herself with a moment's fantasy. Sweeza and Serrano.
Yes. Oh, my. Yes.
The Serrano Legacy, Once a Hero, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1998, Elizabeth Moon. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Elizabeth Demery, Sherry Simpson, Peter Stray, Kate Foster, Scott McCormick, James Konacek, David Coyne, Tom Simpson, Tim Carlin, Jeff Baker, Tim Getman, Mort Shelby, Thomas Penny, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, Sonny Lasky, Jason Stiles, Dylan Lynch, Andy Clements, Ken Jackson, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, and Terrence Aselford. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry and Temeskin Wubna. Book adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. If you enjoyed The Serrano Legacy, be sure to look for Rogue Angel, available at Roadstops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net. Justice League of America, The Flash, stop motion.
All the victims experienced massive head trauma, and their brains appear to have been exploded from the inside out by something that can either exist in multiple locations at once or is moving at super speed.
It's fast.
What is this thing you're dealing with that shaves off a man's skull?
I don't think it's human.
He's done it, hasn't he?
I was using human DNA. I expected a human result.
It is harvesting. It is following its first imperative.
You guessed right, Wally. All the victims tested positive for the metagene. All of them were potential superheroes.
It will keep looking and killing until it finds the donor who provided the DNA that was its root stock.
In fact, it's faster than me.
Copyright 2008, DC Comics. Justice League of America, The Flash, and all related names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics. 2008, DC Comics. All rights reserved.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format.
Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.